up a little early. We've got a full agenda this afternoon, so we'll get started. First up, we have the proposed sewer rate increase presentation. Who's going to lead us to that?
I'll just do a quick introduction here. Periodically, the council considers rate changes in its various utilities, electric, water, sewer, stormwater. And today we're going to present to you an update of the proposed sewer rate increase for the years 2016 through 2021. With us today to make your presentation, who's done the analysis and come up with a report that we'll be sharing with you, is Tom Pavlicek. Tom is with the firm of Municipal Financial Services, and he's been working with us on our rate studies on and off for the past 15 years. So this is the fourth such effort that Tom has been a party to. So with that, I'll have Tom come up and go through the presentation that was sent to you in the council packets, and it'll be available to entertain any questions that you'd have after Tom's done.
Good evening, afternoon, everybody. So we've got about 20 slides, and I see a lot of familiar faces here. It's good to be back. So the first deals with the methodology that we use to do these kind of rate studies, and the first bullet explains, as you're probably well aware of, that it's an enterprise fund, self-supporting, and that the charges we're entertaining here are virtually the sole revenue source for operations and capital spending for all expenditures. And that the second bullet is the nature of those rates are they have to generate revenues sufficient to support everything. Ops and maintenance, capital replacement, debt service obligations, including the covenants that the fund is obliged to in making those payments, and maintaining reserves. And the final bullet is that this is a cost of service study. So it's the second bullet's not quite enough to explain what we're doing. We also make sure that the cost of the services are proportional to each user. So no particular customer or class of customers subsidizes another class.
Does that mean also in the study that existing users will not be subsidizing capital expansion for new development?
That's a separate policy that that's usually comes across in the term growth base for growth. And every city has a different policy along those lines, from absolutely where ratepayers will pay for growth to the other extreme, where growth will pay its entire share. Mm-hmm. So you folks are somewhere in between there, and that's probably going to come up as we just get to some of our slides that deal with the plan investment fee. So the first thing I'm going to walk you through with two or three slides are the customer characteristics, how people use the system. This particular one has to do with the residential users that comprise over 90% of the accounts. So they're a big customer class. And over to the far left of this figure, starting in 1998, the discharge from the average single-family user was very high relative to today, about 193 gallons per day. And we've watched over the 20-some years as the newer homes that have come on are more efficient in terms of water use and wastewater discharge. In the older homes, even the usage patterns have become more efficient. So wastewater discharge volumes have gone down from the average residential user. The number of accounts has increased by various numbers per year, but it's right now we're using about 350 accounts per year for our projections. And looking backwards and forwards from this point on our figure, you can see it's been pretty constant, more or less, the past 6 years, so we're using that to look forward. Commercial number of accounts is a smaller annual growth, but again, we found a trend we think represents the near-term time frame for this study, the next 6 years. This colorful figure illustrates for across the bottom on the horizontal axis, I have listed accounts, flow, VOD, something called TSS, TP, and NH3-N. After the accounts label, those next five, those are the billable units that the council is going to act on tonight. Rates are expressed in terms of those billable parameters. So I'm showing you with the stacked colored columns how each of three different customer classes contributes to the costs and the loadings on the treatment plant. So on the far left side, you see that the blue is residential, while they comprise the majority of the accounts. They are not the majority of the flow to the plant or the other four billable characteristics. And if anyone on the council wants, we can talk about BOD, TSS, TP, ammonia, nitrogen, but just be aware that those are what the treatment plant removes, and those are what we deal with in the cost of service rates. We make sure each customer class pays their share of treating those elements, compounds, they're not elements. This is the approximate replacement value of the wastewater system broken down into above ground and below ground. And what do I mean by that? The treatment plant is above ground, everyone sees it, you can drive by it, and it has a value, if you were to rebuild it today, more or less, $600,000 or $600 million, and all the buried pipe in the four lift stations, maybe $400 million. So the whole point of this slide is to illustrate for the public and the council here the value of the assets that they're operating, that these rates are used to operate. This big group of assets, maybe $1 billion. Plus, remember what the other thing, intangible thing that the rates do is they covenant to the people who lend you money that you're going to repay them. So the rates do two big things. They make sure these assets stay operable and reliable, and they tell your lenders you're good for the millions of dollars that they've lent this enterprise. So speaking of capital expenditures, to the far left, we start in 2016. This gives a rough idea of the long term, obviously it ends in 2039, the 24-year capital expenditure plan. And all the color you see in the stacked columns, the legend shows you that we're looking at three categories of capital expenditures. Blue for the collection system, and that's blankets the bottom line there every year with a $300,000 to $500,000, and then the big lumpy periodic expenditures for treatment plant expansion and for sewer projects. So the first 6 years are what's really on our radar. The next 18 plus years are They help us, well, they help the public and council know that staff is looking forward and just looking beyond the next 6 years. And what this does when we make rates and charges, it just makes sure we're not going to see a spike or a cliff or something odd going on with the revenue requirements. So we look out another two decades. Even though there's a lot of uncertainty in 2039, we look out there anyway to help us plan for this first 6 years. And you can see the cumulative capital, the blue line with the dots peppered through it, that's on the right-hand scale, and that right-hand scale is in millions of dollars. So $660 million over the next 24 years. And we see numbers like this every study. staff and the planning people are not shocked at this. And that's another reason we bring it out in these kind of periodic presentations. So the public and council sees that this is a rather routine planning, given the billion-dollar asset that you're sitting on. So this is a pretty normal pattern of expenditures to keep that functional, that being the billion-dollar asset.
So when you show these capital expenditures, I mean, is there a way of breaking out the capital maintenance versus capital expansion?
Well, and I'm going to ask staff to help me out on that one.
Yes. So, you know, some of those, the green for the sewer projects, some of those are for growing the system, and some of those are for growing the system within the city already for I&I and future growth. Some of the red numbers are for future effluent limits that could be more stringent, such as the one in 2022. If you go to 2030, that's an expansion. If you go to 2036, that's the aged infrastructure. By that time, we have a plant that's 56 years old that treats two-thirds of our wastewater.
And I'll throw that out as kind of an additional request for data right now, is that, you know, what my constituents want to know is they want to know that, you know, they're okay with paying for the stuff that they need, but they're not necessarily interested in subsidizing future growth, and it's hard for me to break it out based on how this is.
Mm-hmm. The item in 2030 is the first one that really relates to future growth.
Okay.
The 2022, that's an EPA, MPCA.
That's if that rule is held up?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So from everything we have, we believe it's going to happen. So it's here. I shouldn't say it's a worst-case scenario, but it's the expected outcome. That doesn't happen. If it was just for us to build a tree, if we could do it until 2030.
Okay.
And this slide is just the 6 years that we're focused on, and it's total expenditures. And again, the colors reflect each category. Operations and maintenance is your base. Then the debt service, annual principal and interest payments. And then capital is two flavors, cash, and then new loans financed. And the cumulative total goes up there. And again, one of the reasons we show this line is, this is a quarter $1 billion, $231 million, almost a quarter billion. And it just goes to show, again, the enormity. This is a large enterprise. It takes a lot of money to run it. It's worth a lot of money, and rates are the only source of that money, besides interest earnings and some other miscellaneous cash flows.
Tom, could you toggle back then to the previous slide? So that $231 basically gets us to 2021.
Correct.
And again, what we're attempting to do is put in effect a gradual increase in rates that takes into account that $58 million in 2022, you get no new capacity for that. That's just a new treatment standard that we have to meet. And so all of the current ratepayers, this isn't about growth, it isn't about expansion. We've got a major expenditure coming out there in year 7, right now, the way it looks, that we need to start building up cash reserves and other funds to help pay for that. So that's why I wanted to kind of go back to put that in perspective. So as we look at the forwards going forward, that slide, you could say, well, once we get to 2019, why can't we flatten that blue line a little bit for the next couple of years? We could. But all of a sudden, you'd see a significant rate increase in 2021 or 2022.
So we're still doing everything on a cash basis in this utility, then not a utility basis in terms of how we. I don't know if you were involved in the RPU discussions at all, but we. Are you familiar with those terms?
Yeah. Okay. Rates are made on a cash basis here. We don't use the utility method where you get where it's your asset is the rate base and you add depreciation.
Yep.
Right, plus O&M. No, we're using a cash basis here.
I had a quick question. If you go back, sorry, you have a really interesting slide here. That's this one here? One more. Yeah. So, it's really effective to look forward at all the huge hurdles we're going to have to jump in the next 24 years. One of the things that I get a bit thoughtful about when I start looking at charts like this is maybe the previous 12 years, along with the next 12 years, and figuring out what we are relative to. You know, cost of operating utility versus like the average income for Olmsted County or something like that. So you can figure out as a percentage of what people earn, what sort of increase we're looking at. Is that some that data else placed in here? Because one of the things, you know, ongoing here is you're right. We don't want a 12% increase in the cost of utility in 2022. I think that would be really upsetting to people. So I think there's. I would like to understand the proposed increases relative to what we're levying for other taxes as well. Because I think this has come up as a part of maybe it's timing, maybe it's otherwise, but come up as part of the broader conversation of cost of living here. And I hate to imagine what it looks like if we wait, but at the same time, as part of the package of increases we're talking about, I want to make sure we're affordable here.
Right. Do you want me to take the credit?
Sure.
What I've seen in other states, in water enterprise in other states, and I think it's nationwide because the federal EPA, I believe, has a definition for affordability for water, and it's if you're not in a disadvantaged community, it's 1.5% of the average income. So you can go on the census website for your zip code and get the average income, household income, and let's say it's, I'm guessing here, so I don't want to, 20,000, 25,000,
30,000?
You would take 1.5% of that, and that would be, if it's not a disadvantaged community, that would be what a TARP maximum bill would be in this community. That'd be affordable. I believe that's how they define it, for water. And we usually do the same thing with sewer, just piggyback on that logic. And so if you're up to 2%, at 2%, I believe they call it not affordable. So there's some stock language you can use to formulate how you stack up. And that's the mechanism I would use if I was asked to do it.
Is that something you'd like to see in the executive summary?
Let me chew on it first.
That's
something you guys are all interested in. We can move on.
Sounds like there's plenty of other stuff to get to.
We look at that for large projects such as the phosphorus limit, because if we are unaffordable, you can negotiate with the state on that.
Yeah.
Good. So the purpose of this slide is to take the costs that were here and put them into numbers and add a little more framework. So there's the fund has cash and investments right now. Like any business, it needs money on hand for working capital, for emergencies, for other things. But we had $231 million in expenditures. There it is, rounded down. And so this is how it's going to get funded. Here's the charges for services. It's actually 78% of your revenue source with some money from the plan investment fee, so-called PIF, and then some new loans. And, you know, the new loans, this is just the rate model. When a new loan actually scrolls onto your needs, you know, it's much more, it's all researched all over again, and Dale and his staff take over and actually, you know, they'll do the issue. It's your, according to your policy and authority. So this was just showing you how it would be funded. We use a little bit of fund balance and at the end of 6 years, you still have a reasonable fund balance. So it's just these numbers in a pro forma, if you will, for 6 years. So now we get into the cost allocation. And that was the colored chart with the six parameters at the bottom. Well, this just shows how that $176 million from charges now gets portioned into rates. So 28% of it is going to come from monthly fixed charges and about 72% from quantity charges. That is dependent on the volume and strength characteristics of the discharge. And now you can see how those charges start coming up in a more familiar sight. This is the reason we put this slide in here. This is actually what council acts on from this vertical line to the right. These are what are adopted and implemented in the billing system.
Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, so I brought this up when we discussed rate charges with RPU, and I kind of see it across all our utilities here. You know, the fixed charge, at the time when I asked the question, they said the rationale there is cash flow. It's something you count on every month. Helps out with cash flow. But what I'd like to see, I mean, I know people are frustrated when they open up their bill and they see this fixed charge when they haven't even, before they even use anything for the month. And it kind of, to me, it's somewhat counterintuitive on different conservation efforts we're asking for people. What I'd like to see is the fixed charge frozen. I mean, I understand you have to have the revenue, but I'd like to see it built into the usage.
That one, this subject matter, what the council member is alighting on, is a whole study in itself. So the fixed charge in wastewater is akin to the meter charge in water. Right? Even if you use no water, you pay your meter charge. So it's a similar concept in wastewater. Even if there's no discharge, you pay a fixed component. So obviously there's a lot of fixed charges in these utilities. A $1 billion utility, a great deal of what you do is fixed whether or not people discharge what you think they will. So do you need to have a fixed charge? Let's just start from that square in wastewater. You don't. But there's at least a handful, and some people would say a dozen, objectives in making rates. So in the council member's one statement, he alighted on a couple. The stability in the revenue source. Obviously, if you made everything quantity-based, or in your water side, it's easy to see. If you had no meter charge and all you had was a quantity charge, and everyone decided to cut back their use, the utility would immediately be compromised in terms of revenues, and they'd have to increase their rates. It's the same thing in wastewater. The more you shift to the quantity charge, the more volatile your revenue stream can become. Now, another reason to have, let's say you had 100% quantity charge. Is it equitable? See, that's another objective. Revenue stability, now I'm on equitability. Well, what if a customer had no discharge? They would pay zero for their sewer. Are they still benefiting from the sewer system? Well, you bet they are. Would anyone want to buy your house if you weren't connected to the sewer system? So there's many policymakers, and I'm speaking to the council, want a fixed charge because it brings equitability to the framework of this charge system. And then you get it, the moment you say, well, I want a fixed charge, now there's, you could go and talk all day, ask two different people, get 20 people, get 20 answers, how much should you get from the fixed charge? And you saw in the previous slide, it was about 27% of your $176 million in the next 6 years. So what the council member is asking on is what's in the council's purview? every city. How high is the fixed charge? Should it go up anymore? And what they would have to do is just dictate in terms of policy directive how they want this rate structure to look. So the policy we've been walking with when we do this cost of service is we've allocated about 27% of that $176 million in revenue requirements to fixed charges. Could it be more? Yes. Could it be less? Yes. We would just need direction.
Mr. Campion.
So oftentimes when we look at a business, we talk about fixed costs and non-fixed costs. So what part of operating our billion-dollar utility is fixed cost?
Well, a lot. See, term fixed can mean many, many things. So on the charges, that's your fixed charge. But is 27% your fixed costs? No. It's much, much more than that. At the margin, and see, you got to talk about, well, fixed over what term? Over the near term, almost everything is fixed. I mean, if you lay off one or two people, should we lower the charges?
Right, but unlike a business where I generate widgets, it's the volume of your monthly bill that's directly attributable to the amount of water that goes as wastewater is small.
Right, in other words, if people cut their use or industry, if you had one big industry leave, your biggest, and your wastewater volume dropped 5%, could you drop your rates 5%?
No. Right, okay.
Not by a long shot.
Mr. Woodruff, got a comment?
Well, I would just say that it's very true that the fixed charges avoid the volatility, and there's something to be said for the maintenance of the utility for everybody. But one of the key things is you have certain utilities that can be very volatile and certain utilities that are not very volatile. Mm-hmm. And when they're not very volatile, it's a lot easier to put a lot more into the quantity charges and the fixed charges. And in general, water and related to that sewer will tend to be more stable and makes it easier to do.
Sometimes. This phenomena has been, if you wouldn't have had fixed charges, this could have been a lot more detrimental to the revenue stream. These flows, this has been a 35% decrease in the volume from
and
the biggest customer.
What I would say, I would say though that this is stable. It's a stable trend, and we know where it's going. Where you get in trouble, we can plan for this. This isn't a big deal. Where you get yourself in trouble is when, on an annual basis, your revenues are jumping around all over the place.
And let me add one more element, and that is when lenders give you money, they go out and they hire Fitch and S&P to rate your debt for the enterprise and for your general fund. Mm-hmm. The raters look at these kind of things, your revenue stability, and at the margin, you know, it might impact your credit rating, whether you get a high A or a low A, and which in fact affects your rate that you're going to get. So everything's intertwined, and at the margin, it'll affect something. If you change this, but it's in your purview to do so. There's a lot of right ways to do it. Let's put it that way. A lot of right ways. So the reserve target, the first bullet is we go to your CAFRs, which most people know, but I spelled it out: comprehensive annual financial reports. So we touch bases with your audited CAFRs to make sure we understood the cash flows. For your annual target money, we have at least these three components, and one of them is a requirement in your debt service covenants. Your lenders require that you carry a year of principal and interest payments, and then working cash is usually 45 days for most businesses. We have a little more because you're not just, you've got more than just working capital. You've got that whole treatment plant and hundreds of miles of sewer pipe to maintain. And then finally, rate stabilization. You've got, let's go back to it, flow, you know, almost one MGD from industry. And it's a pretty stable industry. It's not like a food packing industry and out on the, in a small town where they might be 50% of the flow or more. So you're not captive to your industry or your commercial, but at the margin, if one of them were to leave, you over the long term would need to replace that revenue source or have stranded capacity. So we build up reserves in some years in anticipation of paying for one of these very expensive capital projects. That's the final bullet. And now, you know, this violates every PowerPoint principle known to man. I don't expect you to, for the all the information that's embedded in here to jump out, but let's try. So, and this just goes to show when we make rates, how many things are on our radar? Let's go through them. This bottom one is your coverage ratio. Your lenders require that you be a 1.0 or 1.1 or more. And you can see that right now, and for the 6 years before that, it's been, there's not a lot of slack in the rope. You're making coverage, but you can't run out and issue more debt. These are your monthly bills. The vertical line is the end of the six-year rate-making period. And everything above the zero line is a revenue and downwards an expenditure. And again, we saw earlier the revenues are matched by about $230 million or $225 million of expenditures. The black line's the fund balance. So we make sure that stays over the red line, the target. We want the bills to go up smoothly, and we want to make coverage. So we're trying to hit four targets at once, really, in terms of rate making. That'll satisfy everybody in the community and their representatives at this table. So that was the purpose of the slide. It's in the report, and it can be studied in detail. And it really tells the whole story in just one look. So we've got just a handful more slides before we get to the PIF, so I know we're on a time constraint, so I want to get us there. This one, I looked to the prior study. 6 years ago, when we were in this room, we saw the red stack, the red columns, and the red line. And now we've extended another 6 years here, and we're seeing a different pattern. And the big difference between the two is the last time we did rates, we were trying to recover about $400 million from capital over this rolling 24-year period, and now it's up to about $660 million. Was the $400 wrong? Is the $660 right? This is a, everything at this end of the spectrum, there's a lot of uncertainty in it. So they're both right. In other words, many cities don't even plan to this degree. I've always, it's been a credit to this city that they look out this far with without blinders on to try and anticipate probably a worst case scenario, spending scenario, and just to see how that affects us right here. So this is a rare thing. Most cities wouldn't dare to do this kind of planning because it takes a lot of this is really how a private enterprise might look at things way down the road. So the good news is we haven't wandered too far from what we looked at 6 years ago. And even though we've taken the staff has painted in another significant amount of capital spending. And by the way, it looks like the city may be able to do that with cash after this set of capital expenditures. However they're resolved, there's a lot of uncertainty even in here, whether there'll be cash, how much, whether there'll be debt financed, at what terms. how many years. So it, the city, every time we've come up, done this rolling six-year rate schedule, we've seen a lot more certainty in terms of we feel good that the rate shown here or the bill shown here may be close, plus or minus what was actually going to happen, given any unforeseen natural disaster, human or natural disaster. So this chart, before we get into PIFs, it's starting to bring PIFs into our radar. We wanted to look at how much revenue we get from each customer class, and then from PIFs in general. And so these two vertical lines bracket the six-year planning period we're in. And what this slide shows is that the relative proportions from each of the three customer classes, looking back and going forward, is about the same. And the other message this sends is that revenue from PIFs, I'll start using the acronym, is barely visible. It's, although it's millions of dollars, about $1.5 million in any given year in this time frame, it's not the main source of revenue. And then two more slides dealing with bills, residential monthly bills, that is. The bills are with the dollar labels, and these vertical brackets are each of our six-year rate study periods, with the final one being here. And this green line was the volume of wastewater from the average single family that we saw earlier. That started at about 199, and by the end of this planning period, it's down on just under 120 gallons per day. And now here's the bills matched with percent increase, annual percent increase in the bill. So we're looking at about 5% annually for residential, an average residential. And then we'd start moving into PIFs, plan investment fees, and we start off with the ending. It's the last chapter of the book. These are the recommended fees. So this is for a residential connection. The current is $3,000, so it's $100 a year. Non-residential is expressed in, right now the resolution allows it to be implemented in one of three ways. We're showing two of the ways here, per plumbing fixture unit or based on the water meter size. And the third way puts a cap on it at a multiple of the 2-inch meter. And then for permanent and non-residential customers, that's industry and some very big commercial users, it's a lot like their current operating charges. There's 5 unit costs, and you characterize their loadings, and then you multiply it by these rates, these fees. So the details now, one by one, this is, we're starting to see what the resolution looks like that council will be familiar with, is that there'll be a table showing these, residential only, and then there'll be some language telling staff how to implement these fees, and there's going to be a recommendation that this maximum language be struck, and that it just be implemented using these two approaches, 80% of an equivalent or 50% of the per fixture unit fee. The per fixture unit. Then non-residential, there's their fees again. The resolution carves them up into these tables, so to get the council familiar with what they're going to be acting on, we in our report carve them up like this also.
When you say non-residential, does that in, what about multifamily residential?
Multifamily is down here.
It is, okay.
Yes.
All right.
And then finally, like we saw on the first PIF chart, we have the the industrial fees. And then this figure gives us the history of the PIF for purple residential and blue a 5/8 by 3/4 inch water meter. And then there's going to be, as in every resolution, there's some charges for hauled waste and sampling. The top table is the hauled waste, which has three charges. And each of these three types of hauled waste have radically different characteristics in terms of strength. So that's why they're charged different charges. Portable toilet waste, extremely high in strength and slug shot to the plant when it's trucked in and discharged to the headworks. So it's a different charge. And then fats, oil, and greases down here. And then monitoring and sampling charges, they're in the current resolution. We're bringing them into this study so that council can see everything packaged together. And then this is the last slide, and it's the timeline for our actions. We've been working on the study for a few months, getting all the source data, preparing a draft report in this presentation today, and then this with implementation on January 1.
So, I mean, I see the recommendations for PIF up there, but I don't see anything in terms of what the costs are per PIF. And Dale can correct me if I'm wrong, but currently ratepayers are subsidizing the capital expansion to the tune of more than $5 million a year. Does that sound about right?
Not that, probably.
Yeah, so, I mean, you have these tiny increases in the PIF, even though we've got $5 million a year of subsidy going into this, and I'm curious what that number actually is, what the subsidy is.
Well, these PIFs are going to bring in approximately $8 or $9 million in a 6-year window. So,
I mean, it should probably also be noted that the existing plant and all the existing ratepayers, yeah, they've been subsidized greatly over the years because it was paid for by federal grants. Right? Mm-hmm. So, who paid that? I mean, they didn't, right? So. And to the extent that any new customer is here for more than a year, they're no longer a new customer, and they're paying for those things through rate payment. So,
yeah,
this discussion goes on forever, and one of the big problems that we always have is that trying to get to the point that you're trying to get to, you turn around like we had the last 3 years where there is no development for a while, and who's going to pay the bond payments during that period of time?
Well, and you create a liability and then carry it forward, which is no issue. I mean, you still have to pay the bills.
Those things ahead of time and then
here's the thing. This is something, ultimately, we choose what we do with taxpayer dollars. And right now, today, we're saying $5 million in subsidizing sprawl is more important than transit, is more important than affordable housing. We don't even have the data to...
You can't take that money out of this fund for transit.
There is... Yes, you can. And not directly, but it's money. It's money from the taxpayers. And here's the thing. Two issues. One, I think it's insane that we do that kind of subsidy. It's ridiculous, it's irresponsible, and it's unfair. But secondly, we don't even have the data to look at. And that's what drives me nuts, is I want to know how much every year we are subsidizing sprawl through these types of fee arrangements. And we don't even have the data, and that's what's been so frustrating to me. And we asked for the data when we initiated this project, so I'm going to ask again. I want that data. I want to know what the capital expansion totals are. It's too important, and there are too many things that are not being funded to put this on the back of ratepayers.
You think way back when, what was the number that we came up with that to come up with a PIF with something like?
Well, when we first looked at this 6 years ago, it was $18,000 an hour.
Yeah.
And of course, the council didn't approve an $18,000 PIF charge. We ended up at $2,000,
started at $500.
Yeah. No, I understand that, but there's a can't do business as usual. And if this is where we want to sink the taxpayer dollar, this is where we're going to sink the taxpayer dollar. I think there are more important things, like transit.
The bottom line is it won't change the sewer rates because it just isn't much revenue.
And
so, I mean, if we go back to that slide time where we show what percentage of revenue PIF is, mm-hmm, it doesn't change the equation at the end.
And what we have to do is we have to tie the new growth to when the fees come in. However, you can do that internal to a fund, and over time it will catch up.
Right.
And then those savings, you know, can be, you know.
$5 million, that's a pretty significant. That will, at that time, probably have paid for the expansion.
Could I ask a question, different tack, something you mentioned a couple of times. We've seen our usage go down over time. Other than conservation, what efficiencies account for that reduction over time?
Well, it's your customers are dictating that. So the efficiencies are in there, each of your 40,000 individual households in commercial businesses. And you know what your operators have to do is, and Dale, is we've had to try and anticipate what those reductions in use would be, and anticipate how that's going to affect the revenue stream. So,
well, let me rephrase the question.
Yes.
I understand energy and how newer developments can be more energy efficient.
Its household size has decreased over time. So its household size and contribution per capita is decreased primarily because of water efficient fixtures, shower heads, toilets, sinks. People just use less water because of the energy conservation or the water usage reductions that come with any new toilet, whether it's in a new home or a replacement toilet, for example, in an existing home. Reduction, RPU and Minnesota Energy have had programs for water reducing shower heads. Reduce the amount of water that you use so it's able to come out of the shower head at any one time. So those things plus household size of the household has consistently been decreased.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
So the other thing I saw in there that was just came up was that there's a maximum we charge for people to connect. Is that true? I thought I saw on a page or something like a multiple of the 2+ size.
3 times.
Right. The residential, I believe it was in 2006, in between adoption of the charges, there was this change in how to implement the charges. And that final bullet is what you're alluding to, which put a maximum to what one of these first two bullets could be.
And is that maximum, are there matching maximums for the other classifications?
No.
Okay. What? How many of the residential units hit the maximum?
Most of the complexes.
Well, this doesn't affect apartments because residential pays on the per unit, and then an apartment pays on 80% of the numbers up in the table. So this doesn't affect residential at all.
The cap does.
We're asking you to get rid of that statement.
Who hits the cap is my question.
Well, Richard, do you want to explain that East Bill situation that he's right into?
If you have more than 197 units in a building, residential units in a building, you hit the cap.
Okay. And
well, under that situation, and in Eastview, they were putting all the units in three buildings,
and
that way they couldn't make the cap. But if they put it in one building, it'd be cheaper for them. Same number of units, but if they put it all in one complex, it was less.
Is money. This where they connected them with the...
Yes.
Okay, so they connect them by a hallway, and all of a sudden they eliminate all the fee. Okay, so...
And so this, if they delete that, that will be gone. You won't be
the recommendation is to remove that this year. Do we know how much revenue, what the revenue difference is? Because, I mean... That's one of the things. I don't know why this came in at all. I didn't really, and maybe you can explain again in different words, but your explanation didn't really.
I don't know that anybody has ever paid that. The reason that is there is because when the resolution was adopted back in 2004, we had PIFs for every size water meter that our PU provides. So we had 3/4, 1, 1.5, 2, 3, 4, okay. 6, and 8. Mm-hmm. And some large commercial buildings will have a 3 or 4 or 5 inch or 6 inch water meter size because of if it's manufacturing versus retail, that sort of thing. And so it was, those numbers were big. Mm-hmm. And so the council basically, in those few instances where those may apply, said, no, we're just going to have a cap. And that cap's going to be 3 times the 2-inch. Instead of having a pit for a 3-inch, a 4-inch, a 6-inch, and an 8-inch that never got used. And when they, the one or two times, the number was, I mean, it was hundreds of thousands.
And you're saying that nobody ever hit. So what I don't understand is we just explained a scenario where I thought you were saying, suggesting someone hit the cap. And then you're saying that no one's ever hit the cap.
They could have if they were so inclined to want to put 200 units in a building.
If you put a one big complex, then they didn't have to pay as much. If you had 3 separate buildings, you had to pay more than if you put them all those units in one unit, one complex.
And this
doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
And this has happened.
Right.
Up in Northwest Rochester, is that when you're talking about Eastview? I'm thinking of one in Northwest Rochester where they put the buildings together.
Yes, at Northwest.
Not Quarry Hill. There was a newer one up.
It was on.
Well, Quarry
right
Hill,
next to the Alpha Development.
Quarry Hill, I think, was the unit that came along and that was put in place for.
Yeah.
I think more often they do it for financial reasons. They have to phase things just due to the economics. They can't afford to build all 200 units at one time. They do it in phases.
So I'm just trying to nail this down because I feel like that's a moving target. Removing that will have no effect, is what I'm hearing, because nobody's ever hit it. Is that what you're saying?
If they have, it's been somewhere we
okay.
remember.
All right. So this has no net effect. Okay.
So the other one, I understand that staff is adverse to complexity, but you know we charge more to people. Part of it's proportional to the usage because when there's more usage, there's more expense. We get that. Everyone agrees that that's fair. In the sewer network, there is also more expense added due to geographic sprawl. We do not have any line related to that. There's no factor for that. Now, I realize that makes it complex, but I like to point out that even though that is increasing our costs, we're not factoring that in any way, and that's, you know, yet another reason why I don't support these huge subsidies on the front end, because it's just costing us more over time.
Well, classically, the response to the geography, when someone uses that, the treatment plant sited at the lowest point in the region,
yep,
to the benefit of everyone who's going to tie into the system. Because you only have 4 lift stations. When I look around here, mm-hmm. You know, that means everything's flowing to there by gravity. If you had your treatment plant up on a hill, everybody would pay more. So, but does that mean the person who lives further away should pay more?
And you're actually referring to distance from the plant.
Right.
That's not what I'm going for. What
right.
I'm going for is if you have an acre of land that supports 500 households and an acre of land that supports one household,
yes,
the pipe length of the piping is about the same. And that's, you know, and we understand that that kind of sprawl adds to costs and we don't factor it in.
Well, yeah, but you could. The city could have a policy where developers would have to contribute,
yeah,
you know, to the part of the transmission line that's going to take that additional flow from their larger use on a parcel. And I might add it in, these lift stations is another characteristic where just because your area needs a lift station, almost no utility charges those customers who use the lift station a marginal extra amount for the electricity and the maintenance of that lift station. Because, again, the whole system benefits by the lower cost by having the treatment plant in a certain place and lift stations where they need to be to get the wastewater over a hill or across a creek. But I know that's not what you're alluding to, so I'm not attributing
yeah.
that to you as a question.
Right.
Just as a general comment about how the systems are, why you don't see those special charges for those kind of special facilities.
All right, other questions? This will come forward in October for potential action, correct?
Yes.
Late October.
The question I would have, though, because Michael said he wants certain things, and do you want to see some rate structure developed that would accommodate Michael's concerns? Obviously, those rate structure would be a heck of a lot different than proposed here. Could be, it'd be a lot more about increasing the PIF.
It'd increase the PIF, but it wouldn't change the rates.
Yep.
And, you know, we are the only community in the region with a PIF. And that does make, and I have said before, Michael has got me, I should say it more public. The residential development doesn't pay for itself just in the property taxes, but the residential development is a big part of the economy, and the people that live in there are a big part of the economy. So I also will think about when you're making the decision on the PIF, maybe it would be to your advantage to have all of the single families develop in Byron and Stuartville, and you don't see much of it here because you'd have extra cost here. But that's something you still have to keep in mind, because if you went along with Michael, you'd have $25,000 or $30,000 in that PIF, and that would be quite a drag on anybody building a single family house. Or even an apartment building. That apartment, I think, is right now the PIF with $3,000 for a single family residence, $2,400 for an apartment unit. But it still would drive up the cost of affordable housing also.
So you're doing
I'm just throwing some of these things out.
Yes, and you're throwing out a lot of things that aren't true.
So
here's the reality. Your 30,000 number, not true.
Just what is it?
Not true. Last I looked for a typical single family home, my estimate was 14,000, but it's changed. Doesn't matter, but you know what? That's what we have staff for, is to come up with those. We should understand. Does anyone here think we should not understand how much it takes to bring sewer to a single family home?
The difficulty I have is there's some fundamental flaw, I think, in the basis of the assumption. What you're saying is that suburban development is inherently much more expensive, and I think we have to be careful. That partly why I asked that question about efficiency. Certainly some of the newer developments are more efficient. Mm-hmm. I also think philosophically you have to be careful, because that can cut both ways. If you don't want established development to help pay for the development, mm-hmm. well then new development shouldn't pay for the maintenance of the established development,
yes.
because sewer and water and those things break. Also, philosophically, and I'll wind the clock way back, you know, at some point all houses were new. So where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line that suddenly it's suburban sprawl and way more expensive? I'll bet you that some time ago somebody said, you know what, they're building a new development in Elton Hills. Why should I pay for that? Mm-hmm. That's suburban sprawl. All I'm saying is you have to be really careful making broad statements. I agree with you that we need good data for making the most educated informed decision, but.
And that's the big thing. Staff is giving us no data on this whatsoever. And like I said, budgets are priorities. We talked about this last year. We're putting more than $5 million a year into subsidizing sprawl. Nobody's arguing with that number. That's just the fact of what we're doing. That's the God-honest truth, and staff will come back with that as well. Is that $5 million that we're putting there, in this case through the fees in the sewer utility, is that the best use of that $5 million? Or would we be better off increasing the PIF and reducing the fees and then going through property taxes and putting that $5 million into transit? I would argue that there are many things that are better than subsidizing sprawl, but first and foremost, I want the data so the public can see the decisions that we're making, and that's what we're missing.
And I think you could end up kind of shooting yourself in the foot. Let's say we wanted to build a very nice affordable housing complex in the periphery, and now they're suddenly saddled with a substantial PIF charge. Now it's not affordable.
And I think the key thing is we're probably more than 75% we're subsidizing the upfront cost on this. And what I'd rather be doing is 0% subsidy, but if you come in with a project that benefits the public, like with affordable housing, those are the projects that we could consider some relief on. Not, right now you build a $1 million McMansion in Rochester. The poorest citizen in Rochester is paying extra every month in their sewer bill to subsidize that $1 million mansion. That just seems fundamentally atrocious to me.
This is our opportunity to chime in once again with what we'd like to see in the rate. I'm comfortable with the proposed PIF rate structure as outlined, but I would like to see a five-year freeze on that fixed charge. And I understand the revenue has to come from someplace, but it would come from usage. Those are my thoughts.
So to answer Mr. Quenbold's question, if we are asking staff for some additional information or modeling, that would be an example of one. Is that what you're saying? Let's see what the model looks like if you froze the fixed rate for 5 years. How would the variable rates have to change to still accumulate the same revenue that's needed to fund the operation?
Yeah, I don't think that's hard.
And I'm just trying to determine if that is what all of you want.
Right, and that's why we're
talking about that. That's what we're looking at. I'm not sure it's supported overall, but it's worth looking at.
Others okay with looking at least that modeling, and we'll
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I tend to believe the PIF is too small as well. I mean, it would be something if you came back and told me the PIF was going to go up, you know, proportional to the benefit, but it's a about 3 1/3% increase, and that just seems to be short of what we need in order to make sure that the benefit is matched. But I guess this is just different. I completely disagree on the fixed fee. I mean, these fixed fees need to be able to suck up the entire cost of the infrastructure, because, I mean, heaven forbids we come and get shut down. I mean, it's not like the cost of maintaining that goes away. The cost of maintaining that, even if we pump 0 gallons of anything, is still what the cost of the facility is. So it's somewhat short-sighted, in my personal opinion, to say, you know, let's just fix the fixed cost, because we all know those are going up. So it's, you know, taking an arbitrary element of this and pegging that and saying this won't move. I mean, we could do the same thing with the non-fixed portion, and we could, you know, have that argument. To me, it's more, it should map to, and if we should try and make sure that's as affordable as possible. And that's my big concern, is taking the other property tax increases and all of those other elements and making sure as a cohesive unit we're still an affordable place to live. That's what I would like to see. And part of the data I kind of talked about earlier, and the 1.5% number was a good starting point. But yeah, I don't really support that.
And, you know, they obviously have asked for the data on what is the real cost, because I think that's important for us all to understand. But also, you know, and why I've always disagreed with your number, besides 30,000 just being wrong, is that we've always assumed that it's per property, and it doesn't have to be that way. And I would like to see our residential PIF, if we want to be fair to the developers and give them options, change that from a per unit to a per acre for R1 development. Now you have some decisions to be made, and they certainly do a lot of things within R1 or R1X that reduce their costs as well. And you know that's and I'd be interested in seeing how that would look as well.
Other comments?
So where we were on the fixed debt, now just on the fixed rate one, you had Mark made a suggestion, had agreed with it. Nick doesn't. How about the rest of you? Says that something you still want?
I'm okay with looking at that model to see what would happen, how the variable revenue would have to change to still accommodate the revenue needs.
Oh, so we just, I mean, yeah, if we're just talking about studying it, I mean, go ahead. And it shouldn't take much to fix that number and run the numbers right. I mean, I'm okay with looking
well,
at
and it. Well, and I would just suggest the council members just put together, you know, what the additional information they'd like to see, send it to Steve, and you can compile it for us. And
well, I think all
I'd like to make sure there's a consensus of what the consultant does, though, somewhat.
Send them running down.
So, your suggestion, Michael, would you want what now?
Well, two things. I want to know what the PIFs would be if we were not subsidizing development. That's the first thing. And the second, what the PIFs would look like if we translated the single-family residential development to a per acre instead of a per connection charge. Those two things.
So if we rephrase that to be as unincendiary as possible, it would be what is the PIF for the connection fee? Like if we just take the cost of the raw cost of the connection has to be covered by the PIF, what does that make the PIF?
So
I think that's a reasonable thing.
It's all tied to the number of connections. We're assuming 350 new residential connections per year for the 6 year.
Is that the right number? No, and here's what I would say. Maybe for the pipe portion of that might make sense. But really, we know that we have X amount of capacity that we created.
Based on, you take the number of customers equals the revenue.
That's the revenue side, but the cost side is what we need to understand.
Is it though?
It is. That's
no, it's
it
not. Because if the length of the debt service was the exact same length of the capacity, then it would be.
We're recovering that cost through the SAC charge. That's paid for with the SAC charge the developers pay. That pays for the pipe.
Okay. And that's what I'm saying. So if the capacity that we created with the last expansion, let's say that capacity lasted for exactly 20 years, then the PIF should pay that debt service over the 20 years. But what I'm saying is, and from what I understand from talking with staff, that's actually a pretty close assumption. It sounds like that's pretty reasonable. I think I asked Chet about that.
It was at $18,000 per residential.
Yeah, so that is a fair assumption, but so if that's the way it works out, I'd be fine with that.
There is SAC charge pays for the pipe. It pays for the plant.
Does that is it the immediately adjacent pipe or is it the capacity in the existing? Because
it's the pipe.
That's okay.
So, Mr. Ruskin,
Stephen, you said who else has capacity in the area?
I think they're only in the metropolitan area. Right. Now, I asked this developer that was building that East Ridge, and he said, well, they didn't have a PIF up there, but I think they probably call it something different. But I don't think there's any PIF outside the metro area.
So in this area, if we're somewhere in the area between $14,000 and $30,000 per PIF per house, you say 30, he says 14. I just caution the council that, you know, we're talking about possibly $20,000 higher than anybody in the region before they put a shovel in the ground to build homes. So there's a good chance if these kind of thoughts are put into play, that a lot of our new developers and that are going to go to the outside of the city limits to the surrounding communities and be able to get right off the bat $20,000 less. So, you know, it's just something to keep in mind when we're looking at this PIF fee. It's already a pretty big burden right now on the people that are out there and the cost of a new home, along with everything else they have. So, something to think about.
But I think the bigger picture of the PIF is where you want to be at some point in the future. You can't get there today. You're not going to raise it to 14 mm-hmm. or 30. If you agree with the principle, the idea, you want to get there in another 10 years, you want to get there in another 20 years, and where is that you want to get? You want to subsidize 50% or you want to subsidize zero? Mm-hmm. That's the direction we need. Because again, when this was adopted back in 04, it was the fact that we were going to phase this in over time. Mm-hmm. And started out at $500. And it went up $500 a time for 5 years, and then it's been $100 ever since then. So we just need to know what the target is that you want to hit, and we can give you some recommendations on how to hit that.
Just one little comment. On the issue of sprawl, 20 years ago and 15 years ago, sprawl to us was not development in the city, because sprawl in the city, everything's on municipal services. The sprawl to us was the large amount of development that occurred right outside the city limits of Rochester, which wasn't on municipal services. So I'd be a little careful with the term sprawl. I see all development in the city as at least municipally efficient, some less so than others. His point would be it's less, lower density development isn't as efficient as high density development. I think that is true. But I wouldn't call what's going on inside the city as sprawl. I would usually that, in most people's term, that is larger development that's outside of the city. So.
And my simple term for it is any development that can't cover its costs on an ongoing basis, mostly single-family residential, because we know that's it's a money-losing investment. Every time we do it, we're making another money-losing investment, and I'd rather actually see that happen in other municipalities than ours.
The biggest loss of investment is if it occurs right outside the community rather than in the community, because then you get zero.
The question to you would be whether or not, as a group, do you want to see us have different PIF targets than has been proposed?
Ed says no, Mark says no. I say, show me the data.
Well, that's what it is.
We'll give you the data. We'll give you the data, and then you can decide.
But I do want, because I've been talking about these enormous subsidies, and I do want to get everybody on the record whether or not they're okay with having these massive subsidies. And now, Mr. Ruskin,
I think you're characterizing it wrong, and I do disagree, but for the reasons you're not saying. I think you have to look at the bigger economic picture. Certainly, we are subsidized. I get that. I understand that. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. But you look at the larger economic picture: the jobs, the growth, the economy you're growing for the city. Sometimes you do pay more, but you're going to attract far more in the long run. So I think you really have to keep in mind the bigger picture. So I am going to disagree with you on that one, but I'm keeping in mind the bigger picture.
But I would say that why does different types of growth result in less jobs or economic activity? I don't believe that's the case.
Attracting more workforce to our community, which we badly need, by the way.
They're not going into single-family detached housing.
The workforce? The problem we've got is the market is driving us. we wouldn't be building these homes and these subdivisions if people weren't demanding it. People want that product.
At this price.
And I don't think you'll price yourself out of the market.
Okay. Then they'll buy something different.
Outside of Rochester.
Or they'll buy different kinds inside of Rochester. Most of the residential units that are being built today are multifamily. Right? Right?
But they all have a PIF.
Yes, they do. It's more efficient. So, but I do want that question answered, though. Are we okay with this?
Well, back to my question. So far, I want to know whether or not that PIF target that we have recommended is agreeable. And so far, two of you said it is. One of them it isn't. So how about the rest of it?
I'll let others answer.
Well, I don't see anything wrong with addressing, having more clarification of the data. Michael has brought this up many times, especially you talk about sprawl. You made a very good example when you talk about sprawl at Elton Hills, because certainly many years ago that was out in the boondocks.
I don't
know
if anybody lives on Elton Hills.
So I don't know how much staff time it would take, but at least it would bring some closure to the concern about the subsidizing, the suburban development. You said SAC is paid by the developers, so I don't know about the $20,000. If people moved outside of the city, were $20,000 more, that would be the additional cost of the house, of the homes, because we had PIF. Is that correct?
No. Well, I guess what they could build in other towns, not pay the PIF, so they start out with saving whatever that they'd have to pay in Rochester.
Well, I've heard a long time about this, and I know it's very hard because I don't really, this is very complicated for me, but if the council members want more data to help in making an assessment of what we would do for the residents in this city, and it wouldn't take a year, it would take a short time, is that correct? Could we have it?
Yeah, I can almost give you the answer right now.
What give
you? You're collecting 25% of the debts, annual debt service with PIF revenues. Your annual PIF revenue is about 25% of what your annual debt service is associated with the last expansion.
What PIF did we have 10 years ago? What was it?
The first year was $500.
But I mean, what was our percentage back then?
It went 500. It went up by 500 increments up to 2,500, and then from there it's gone up $100 a year.
So the percentage of 25% of right now you're saying is funded through PIF. What was it 10 years ago?
Literally nothing. So the new ones now are moving, all the people before
10 years ago didn't subsidize.
And even if you set it at $18,000 on the years where there isn't much development at all, it's still nothing.
We can go down the path if that's the way we've always done it. I just don't believe in that.
So I kind of get back to my target. If you're at 25% today,
go four times.
Do you want to? You'd have to increase four times, but they basically $12,000 to $14,000.
$14,000. Where have I heard that?
Today, in order to cover your annual debt service associated with the expansion that was built in 2006.
I think one other point, it's not the way we've always done it, because in the past, like the big expansion that occurred before the last one, mm-hmm. was paid 90% with federal and state funds. Mm-hmm. So basically, it was a free. It was 10% was paid by the state back in that.
We're estimating 350 new residential customers per year. Back in 2006, we were averaging 350 new connections per year. Back in 2006, 10 years ago, it was four times that. So the revenue was four times as much.
All right. So we can hopefully bring this part of the agenda to closure. What's your preference? There's a question on the table as far as, and I've heard the one that we'll look at is keeping the fixed charges frozen for 5 years and see what that does to the volatility of the variable. And then I hear Mr. Wojcik, he would like to look at, based on actual cost, what would the actual PIF need to be to, I'll use the word break even, And then he's also asking, what would that need to look like if you charge based on per acre versus per unit? So I'm here in support for Mr. Hickey's request. What about the other two?
Well, Richard just answered one.
Okay. And my opinion on that is not that I'm opposed to looking at the information. I just think that it's kind of an academic exercise because the number, as we're hearing, starts to become unsustainable in terms of promoting sorts of development and growth. That's my opinion.
I mean, is 14,000 unsustainable?
Well, the fact of the matter is it's going to get passed on to the
right, exactly. It'll get passed on to people building single-family homes who are among the absolute wealthiest in the community.
I just want to point out something here for you guys. We're assuming that the debt ends at the time the expansion reaches max capacity. That's not necessarily a true statement.
And
so if we start looking at the characteristics of residential homes, there's probably a lot more homes that will fit into that that capacity. So, you know, we're saying 14 or 18 or whatever number it is. It's not necessarily the number. That's assuming 350 homes per year pays for $5 million in the bond.
Right, but Mike, debt service also climbs over the next some years too, so we'll be increasing that number if we're going to try and keep up with that.
So there's a lot of different ways you can look at the debt. You can do whole plant costs, you know, close to $1 million.
So the debt service is increasing, and that we just said. So the relative amount contributed is going to decrease.
I mean, we refunded it, so it isn't increasing as much as it was because we got a refinancing deal on it, but it's still climbing. We built it that way originally because we knew we weren't going to cover all of the.
But less than a 3 1/3% increase.
Yeah, I think it climbed up to as high as $7 million. I think by the time we get a few more years out there, I got to look at it again. I'm not
sure. I mean, I think 25%, we're probably a little bit lean there. I don't think anyone is going to support a $14,000 amount, but I think there's 14,000 or minus 3,000 shades of gray between the two, so we can find something there. If you're looking for direction there, I mean, to me, the direction is clear. You know, we don't want to leave the future of the city with a non-functioning utility here. You have to make sure you're paying into it appropriately to fund the future expansion, and otherwise we're just taking what we should be paying now and burning the future with it, and that's not the way to run a city. So that's my take.
So again, what do you want to do on and I'm just looking at the question of the actual it sounds like the question has been asked and answered. We think it's around 14,000 if you wanted PIF to pay for the actual expense.
Yeah.
So now what staff would ask for is, so what do you want the target to be? Do you want it to be 14,000 or somewhere in between?
You want
3 and 14?
7 by the end of the 5 years?
I would, I mean, to me, 50% is a huge, I mean, that's 200% or 100% closer than we are now. And if we target that over a decade of increase, what does that look like? I mean, these are what I'd like to do is sit down with what you guys are suggesting now, this conversation, and actually look at the numbers. I mean, I don't think it's overly useful for me to sit here and guess and check with a crowd waiting to talk about block grants.
Okay, so what are you asking?
Let's table it and bring it back.
Perfect,
then I don't even need a motion.
Well, here's what I've got. I've written down that myself, Sandra, Nick are willing to look at it. Randy's open to the data. Mark and Ed are just fine with where it is today, and I just don't have Mr. Bilderbach.
And I'm not opposed to looking at it. I just don't know if I support it. I'd have to see the numbers, and that's what I really want. I want to see the numbers.
So that's 4.
Show it to me that if we were trying to go to 50% versus 25%, show me what it's at. I'm not saying
I don't want it, and I don't want my dart to be used as a talking point.
Well,
I just threw a dart out there.
Right, you did, and that's fine. But
you
I think
couple, I mean, I always going to model a million of these.
I know.
Things.
Right. Well, literally, I'm going to go and model. You know, it's pretty simple.
How many years are left on
the bond? I want to see how that looks in the
project. So this is
that's my opinion.
Yeah. Well, let's bring back the number.
Okay. That's all I'm
saying. Do you want it by lot size or just by unit?
Well, I'll put my pitch in for this too. That when you do it by unit, there are different types of development that can come about, and you take away the flexibility of the developer to do smarter things. And I think that's the big advantage of looking at this stuff per acre, because it's really a coverage area that you're able to build out when you do these expansions. So that's why I think that giving an option of looking at a by acre gives developers the ability to do some smarter things.
And that's just for single family then, because with the apartments, yeah, it wouldn't fit.
You're right. This is for the single family, which is...
I'll look at it. I'm not saying it's important, but I would look at it.
The per acre, though, doesn't really work for wastewater, because even if you reduce flow, you know, the connections are paid for by SAC and the developer. So we're talking about just the plant investment fee. Whether you're an apartment complex or, you know, you're a big house, you know, you're typically... Your wastewater loading rate is...
Surprise.
Right, but your wastewater pound per day of BOD...
But you know, I think everyone, including myself, is not willing to go to $14,000 tomorrow. But if we're going to be allotting subsidy, maybe there's some, we should do it in a smarter way than just across
really
the board.
So really, another way, you're looking at a density bonus type thing,
yeah,
versus a per acre. So
yeah,
if you get 12 units per acre versus two.
Mm-hmm.
So you do want to look at it on a per acre basis versus per unit for a single family.
Yeah.
And now, are you going to be able to pull all this information back in time for us to...
Because what I'm saying, though, is that it wouldn't matter. You know, if you had
one... change the rates.
It doesn't change anything.
Change
you had one home on an acre or one home on a...
Yeah, right.
Because the overall revenue...
You're still going to have the same rate fee.
So, do we take that off the table for now, or...
Wait.
I thought that's what he was...
You said it wouldn't make any difference.
Not
he wouldn't would make difference to the rates. It makes difference to the PIF.
But what I'm saying is the loading would be the same.
The loading is on the rate side. The PIF is on the development side.
It's a capital. But you're paying for pounds per day in the plant and for treatment. That's what the PIF is. That's what you're paying for.
Mm-hmm. We're subsidizing it one way or the other. So how do we get the best bang for our subsidy?
So I'm lost. I'm not sure what you want to look for.
We got you covered.
Okay.
Okay.
We're going to understand.
All right. You should understand. That's important. Okay. So hopefully we'll have some information to look at before it's over. All right. Well, okay. That was fun. Let's talk about property tax levy.
Okay. Let me lead off on it.
Go ahead.
I previously sent you some projection that we made, Rachel and Carrie had put together, indicating what kind of a property tax increase would be needed if we projected no new employees at the 2.5% salary adjustment that we made, and then all the other little materials and supplies was adjusted at 3.5%. And so that came in at an increase of about $2.5 million in order to kind of stay everything where it's at. No new employees. So then I put together for your consideration what I would be suggesting in terms of new positions out of the ones that were recommended by all of the departments, and I have attached that for your review and to see who. I'm not expecting any feedback from you on them today, other than that eventually by next Monday, when you have to adopt the preliminary property tax, will determine how much money, if any, you want to provide to new positions. And once that figure is known, then I work with you to determine the priorities of any of those positions that may be added. Now, today I did get some information from Carrie and Rachel also on what the departments have asked for in 2016. And they would be asking for $750,000 more than that $2.5 million in their requests. And that's also with no new positions added. Now, obviously, everything they're asked for won't be able to be provided to them. The major increases that I'll be looking at in the departments of the human resources are up $123,000 over last year. Police are up $1,059,000, fire $639,000, emergency management $105,000, economic development $149,000. I think most of that is the cash flow from the hotel motel tax that goes to the convention bureau. Library up $336,000, and then park and forestry and landscape maintenance, $222,000. And so that would, if you gave them what they want, have asked for, that'd be $3.5 million or a 6.5% increase with no new positions. And so I would recommend to you that we stay with the $2.5 million and then determine what new positions, if any, you wish to add. And then it'll be up to me to work with the departments to weed out, I guess, down to a manageable number, appropriations that will fit into whatever property tax levy you ultimately adopt. And so that's my introduction for your discussion.
And I'll start with the comment I ended up with when we talked about this last time. You're recommending in the neighborhood of 4.6%, and that's with no new positions. Basically accommodates cost of inflation and so forth. And I had posed that for every 1% increase in the levy equates to roughly $530,000, which roughly pays for about five positions, depending. So I was suggesting an initial levy of around 7%, and I just used a round number, allowing the 4.6 plus a couple of percent that would potentially allow us to fund up to 10 or so positions. The good news is some of the positions will be accounted for by fees, but nevertheless, I was just making an argument that we should set a number a little higher. We can always come down, but we certainly cannot go up after the end of this month. So that, I'll just start there and see what others think.
I'm supportive of what you're saying. I don't. Do you think it gives us enough runway? That would be the 2.6, because we've also got we've got that $17 million a year that we're, you know, short on what our maintenance needs are on just the roadways. And I mean, we're not going to add $17 million this year, but you know, I want to start us going in these directions towards getting to financial sustainability. And you know, in terms of setting the prelim limit, I've always been of the opinion to take whatever the maximum allowed by state law, whatever ridiculous number that is, and set it there every time, because it doesn't mean anything anyway. But
I just picked that number based on some rationale that I could come up with, open to ideas.
What is the maximum?
You don't have a maximum limit.
I think, yeah, there actually are maximum millage rates. We're just so far away from it that it would never come into.
Some years we have maximum legislatively introduced on us, but not this year.
So, and quite frankly, you know, I'm sure the public and myself, we're all sensitive to the cumulative effect.
Yeah.
We know that whatever number we pick, you know, there's more than likely a county, a school, district, and so forth. So, you know, I do have that sensitivity. There's a balance. We do need to fund our operations to provide the services our public demands, but we try to be conscious of it as well.
Yes. So, as Michael suggested, we put it higher than?
I don't have, this number does not influence my take on the budget whatsoever, so, you know, I'm happy putting out a number that's ridiculous enough that everyone knows it's not the case, because this is an activity that's not something that we want to do, it's something that's forced on us by the state before we are into our budget process. Ultimately, at 7%, we know about 5% is going to be eaten up in terms of, that covers your inflation and your growth in building properties in the city, so that's even at 7%, it's pretty manageable hit once it gets to the individual property taxes.
Other comments?
I agree with you on the cumulative effect that we're going to see. I mean, even though we're seeing expansion of properties in the city and growth, we shall take up some of that, it won't take up all of it, but I think I could live with 7. It's going to make our job difficult, which it always is, and that's fine. But I could live with 7.
Mr. Hickey?
I had a question. Last year we kind of ran into that, but we had kind of factored in the gas fee and potentially other fees. So making the assumption that we don't adopt any new fees, would the 7% be enough in your estimation just for the tax levy?
It would provide about $1 million. If you look at those by recommended positions, about $1 million. So you could probably do those positions or some substitutes along those same lines that I recommended with 7%.
And that's with no additional fees.
Right.
Okay. That's substantially more than we've done in the last few years. The last few years, we're lucky if we did three or four positions.
Mm-hmm. Clarity, Steve, on your memo here, you have three fleet patrol officers, and then talk about the radio specialist to be replaced by one police officer. So are you, you're talking the net effect is four new...
Four more patrol officers.
Four new patrol officers, that's okay.
Because there's a sworn police officer now doing that job that a civilian would replace, so then that position would go out on the street.
Okay, so the net effect is four new officers.
Yeah.
Other comments? I'm not wedded to my number. I just gave you the rationale that I came up with.
And I do. I have some questions about dispatch as well, but I think that serves a lot of different functions. But I'm willing to take those issues and arguments down the road. But again, I can live so.
Ms.
Mead? I just had a question about the one administrative assistant trying to find the development fees, so this is a new position.
That would be a new position, and that would be under the assumption that you would adopt those development fees to cover the cost.
And is this, this is just salary or salary plus compensation or...
That would be the salary. That would be the total cost. If they take the police officer is $110,000, but that includes the base wage, the benefits, and all the other equipment, clothing, those things.
Vehicle.
I think there's a vehicle in it too, Roger.
Yeah.
Did you about two vehicles? One.
So, obviously, we'll have lots of opportunity to dive into the detail of the numbers as the budget comes forward. Our only responsibility today is to set that initial levy. And again, we can come down, but we can't go up. So, what would you like to do?
I'm in agreement with 7% or so that we will have enough flexibility so that Mr. Quindrold can... have some room to work.
Okay. Other thoughts? Mr. Freeze?
Can I ask a question? Does your 7% include then any money toward building up a fund for street
no.
capital?
No. Wouldn't be in there.
Yeah, I'm not designating any particular use. I just want to give us the latitude to at least talk about some of those things.
I just wasn't sure if it did or not.
Right.
No, I don't think the CIP is any higher than last year.
It would be, CIP would be relatively the same. Hopefully we can have some room to put something in there.
Your 7% number only, that gets us, that was about 1 million for positions, right?
Yes.
Right.
And I guess, I think we need to do something with the CIP. That's
tricky.
Yeah, if we need to go higher, throughout all the past years, we talked about various things like the gas franchise fee. Overwhelmingly, people have told me, just raise my property taxes. So I'm sure that may change now that we're actually considering it. But I don't want to paint ourselves into a corner. Certainly, street infrastructure and the CIP and got a lot of our needs. So, this is the time to do it if we're going to... get it right.
So 7% covers cost of living, inflation, and the recommended positions. So there really is...
The suggested just happened to come out to about $1 million.
Yeah, just give or take. Just give or take with me here. But so what we're really asking is, do we want further investment into other parts of the government beyond the staff positions?
Yeah, it really comes down to if you want the flexibility.
It would have been suggested to me by finance that we include another $345,000 for the CIP.
Mr. Ruskin?
Well, I'm reading right here, 4.6, so that gives us 2.4% to work on positioning and other things that we think are priorities at this point. And then and we can also maybe find some efficiencies in that, too. So I'm comfortable with it.
Can we do another half? I mean, can we do half percent, or are you just doing whole numbers?
You can do
I would do 7.5 to me. I mean, Again, that's saying that's just a half percent toward all of the SIP projects we're looking to do, which is a drop in the proverbial. I mean, it's not. It's real money. I don't want anyone to suggest otherwise. But in terms of the amount of projects we're looking at, I mean, it's a drop in the bucket.
So what I could do for your meeting on the 28th is just list the percents and the money, and then you pick the money, or you pick the amount of money you want.
Well, we're setting it now anyway, right?
But well, you're not setting it till Monday. Our next Monday.
Based on how far we are behind on the street maintenance and having done a tour, I would like to see us mostly in the street maintenance. I don't know how your 300 plus thousand where that fell in, but
I'm not sure where it was.
Most
it was just 10% above last year.
Oh, 10%. I mean, I'd like to see another half a million into the preventative maintenance, the mill and overlay, and the chip seal, the stuff that, you know, extends the life, and that would be about 1%, so that'd be about 8%.
So, just so the council has all the information, I think we need to make this decision. There is no tax levy money that's going into the street program currently.
Yeah.
And in 2016, right now, we're projecting basically we have 1.9 million of reserves, and then that's it.
However, you've spent a lot of money out of
right,
that.
And we're 4.5
so we put it in there.
In the hole.
Okay, and the last time I looked, there's still 5 point something in that account, depending on how much money we spent recently.
How much are we spending a year on street maintenance?
Last year, just in street overlays, you spent almost $2.4 million.
And that was like another 1.2 or something for chip seal, or
yeah, and there's 1.9 available, I think, for next year.
So we've been spending pretty good money out of
that. But after that, there's none.
This is one-time money that's gone forever.
Yeah.
Just go back. Just the fact that what we need to do is come up with a number. I mean, that's what we can argue. We're going to be arguing over this later or having a long, lengthy discussion. But right now, we need to come up with a number.
Just for us, did you say six? Or?
No, I'm just going to look at your recommendation.
Okay. So I'm hearing the police look at 7 to 8. To see what those numbers are.
If we go 8%, what that could be, which we have not used tax levy for the CIP in the past.
Well, Richard, we had two accounts that by overlays when we're done, and we merged them into one. And so we've had quite a bit of money being expended out of there. But what I will do for your 28th is indicate, you know, what we have left, what we've spent for the last few years in street overlays and what we have left. We haven't, what Richard was talking about, we haven't put any tax levy into those accounts, although we've replenished them with other monies into those accounts. I'll put together what we've spent on those streets over the last few years and what we have left, and then you can determine what you may want to do for 2016, how much money you might want to direct towards it.
I was looking at the streets as a safety issue, and if we need to put some dollars out of our tax levy to support getting those enhancements to our aging infrastructure, could we do it? Or you said there are other sources that you could draw from?
There's not basically other sources. What we've done, we put some future construction monies that from projects that are closed out back into replenishing some of those. But it isn't any extra. It isn't any extra monies.
So how we divvy it up, that'll be part of the rather lengthy budget discussion. I think all you're suggesting is in the RCA that comes forward in September. You'll just show the dollar equivalent and show like 7, 7.5, and 8%.
Right. Because you'll have to pick a dollar amount.
Pick something from that. And then the distribution, that's later.
Here's the big question for the council then is there's a fixed amount of money on there, and we know we've been draining it down, and we know further the rate we're draining it down isn't actually doing enough maintenance anyway. When that goes to zero, the question is do you want an instantaneous huge jump to do street maintenance in your taxes, or do you want to start putting some levy dollars in there over a number of years so that mitigates that hit?
And I would agree, we don't want to zero it out. We don't want to zero it out.
So, that would be the thing. If the answer is that we need to start building up our street maintenance dollars, and you know,
some past years you did put $1 million a year in there.
Well, and that's, and I was being conservative, asking for a half million, which would be 1% would leave us at 8. I would just say with the staffing positions, I don't necessarily agree with the list the way it's laid out, but I think that we could work with those amount of dollars and prioritize. But that leaves $0 for enhancing street maintenance, and that's why I push more for the 8 is to.
So 7, 7.5, and 8 are the numbers dollar equivalents you'll bring back, and then I'm sure we'll have a lot of interesting discussions on how to distribute the budget. All right. Okay. Mr. Spade, you want to talk to us about CDBG or Mr. Jackson?
Yeah.
You're going to get to hear from me today.
Yay!
Brent Chassie, now I'm going to talk about two things. I'm going to talk about the block grant program itself and the city's home rehab programs. And Mr. Wojak had mentioned at the council meeting about comparing like Northfield and other communities.
Yeah.
So this might be an appropriate time to explain the difference, how the city of Rochester gets their funding. And they're considered an entitlement, and that's because of population. And then they take in, as far as the amount of money, they take in for the age of the housing and the income and whatnot of the city. Like Northfield and other cities, they're considered small cities, so they have to apply through the Department of Economic Development. It used to be DTED, now it's just DEED, I think. So what Brent just handed out is just kind of an explanation of what I'm talking about. So the entitlement program, the block grant, it is the city of Rochester, it is your program. So it belongs to the city and they are to administer it. You are to administer it. HUD has their money strings attached. National objective, you have to meet a national objective, and I have them listed here. What kind of activities you can do under the program. And also, every 5 years, a consolidated plan has to be done and priorities have to be chosen. So when you get into the non-entitlement communities, they have exactly the same requirements. It's just that they are not large enough city to get direct funding, so they have to apply, and they have to apply with an activity. So rehab program, a lot of times it's used for water towers, whatever small city needs are. Regarding reporting, the city has to do an annual report that's due at the end of March for the previous year. I do that. It's done into an electronic system, but I also do a paper system, paper report, and that is out on the city's website under City Administration, Economic Development, and HUD approves that reporting. And then HUD also does an annual review of everything that is input into their electronic system. And then they send a letter to, this year went to Steve, sometimes it goes to the mayor, they flip back and forth. But it gives you, they do a little pie chart and gives a little explanation of where the different allocations went and how much percentage of the block grant money and how it was spent. So I also have that listed under the review. And just to give you an idea, for housing, almost 65% of the block grant money is spent under housing, which is good. Leveraging the funds, in the reporting that I do to HUD at the end of the year, we have to report the leveraging resources. And so I included the year 2013 and the year 2014 of funds that were leveraged using block grant money from the different activities. Staffing, it's the city council, city administration. It has, because of the consolidation of the planning department, there's an agreement that planning can do city programs, and in that request they have asked that the block grant program be administered by planning, so that's why it is where it is. It relieves the responsibility and actually cost of city administration. I know I'm going kind of faster, so I apologize. So if there's any questions on that, I will be glad to address them.
Any questions for Teresa? We'll explain the voting process.
Looking at this now for the first time, but it would appear that. So the question I had about the city home rehab, you said that there were some opportunities to get some additional leverage funds, but it was about $696 in here. Are there some other funds that are not showing up?
I'm going to talk about that under the Jerry passing out. All that's right. Actually the city home rehab program.
All right.
Yeah, the report, the page that you're looking at under the block grant program, that's all activities for the block grant. So as you'll see, it's all Bridge and anyone else that participated. Under the city's home rehab program, and again, I emphasize that it's the city's, it is your program. It was established in 1983. The council did have, back in 1983, they saw the need to provide, preserve, and maintain affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So since 1983, the city council has allocated $5.4+ million to the city's rehab program. We've had a repayment of over $700,000 that goes back into the city's rehab program. Over the years, in 83, the program was kind of a different kind of character. It had grants and it had loans and whatever. So back in 1987, they just went to the zero deferred loan. And then in 2013, we went to the 2% deferred loan. And deferred means that nothing changed. They don't pay it back until they sell the property or they're no longer residing there. When the city council gets requests from other agencies to do rehab programs, they have to meet the same requirements this rehab program meets. So sometimes you're reinventing the wheel not that you can't give it to other agencies, but they have to, thinking that you're going to be saving money and maybe time, but they have to do exactly the same thing that your city rehab program does. Other funding sources, Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, they have what's called a fix-up program that is not administered by staff. They have to go through a lender, and they had them listed, and it was Home Federal, I think. And we, our staff has no contact as to who participates or anything like that. We're just a referral agency. The other one is the Rehabilitation Loan Program, and Ron Mathias, who does the city's rehab program, also administers this program. What their features are, but the most important thing is on this page 3, I did a comparison of the income requirements for the MHSA program and the income requirements for the city's rehab program. MHSA is very low. So it's not very often that we can combine those two programs. And Rob gave me some information about during 2014, there were 6 loans that were completed under the MHFA rehab program. And of the 6 projects, 3 were mobile homes, 2 were single family in Rochester. And this program is countywide, so there was one that was completed in Byron. And other affordable housing programs, TIF, which I have no information, but I think you are aware of it, or Terry and Gary can explain it, housing revenue bonds. And a new one is the Umpqua County HRA tax levy. Planning staff has been working with the Umpqua County HRA and hoping with their funding level, they are looking at creating a rehab program, and we're hoping that it to complement these two programs. Rehab programs will complement the city's rehab program. That's it. I know I went through it quickly, but yes.
So I'm just wanting to get the wordage straight. Neither the program or the dollars were reported in the Maxfield study. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. And the $5.5 million that the city's invested in the program, I think you say 776 has been revolved.
Correct.
Do we know how much of that is the balance waiting to resolve? Have we written off some of those? How exactly?
Well, we have lost some because of like foreclosure.
Sure.
The city doesn't get their money back, but it's deferred. It's since 1987, if they still own their property, they do not pay it back.
So my share is still sitting out there.
Oh, definitely.
It's we've only, what do we get, one a year maybe, if that.
And actually, 2014 is a big year. We just figured out we got over 100,000 back.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry, in 2015. So, but normally it's an average of about 80,000.
So
we have those lean years, so.
Give or take 1/50th is revolving.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Brent,
do
you
want to
explain what you're expecting by Friday?
Yep.
From the council.
So at the last council meeting, you guys had a public hearing on those applications that the city received. I did send those applications to the council members via separate cover based on the length of the applications. Along with that, I also sent out an appropriation sheet that lists each of the applications that we received and the dollar amount that they were requesting. So I do ask you that by Friday of this week that you return that sheet filled out with your desired amount that you would want to give that applicant, and then we'll discuss this again at the homing next Monday as far as the appropriations for the applicant. And then the council will have a public hearing at your first meeting in October to award the dollar amounts for the agencies.
I think the discussion next week could be real brief. Typically, what we've done in the past is once the council members have provided the staff, you know, with their spreadsheets, we can go through and look and determine which ones have received the four or more votes and would be recipients of funding. What happens is when we average them out, sometimes there's an unallocated balance left there. That's the amount we probably would just want to talk with you about if you have an idea where you'd want to put that. If, for instance, if you know one of the requesters received three votes, but you know there's a will on the part of the council to provide some additional funding there, you know, you could do that. It's just this, sometimes, you know, when it's all said and done, it doesn't amount to the total.
It's usually not a large amount anyway.
No, but that's really what we're dealing with there.
Right.
So it should just take a moment.
Mr. Newman?
Just one comment. Our office has been the strongest supporters of this program since it started, and I think the reason we thought it was such a good program was because it's the only funding source we have that is really going back in to kind of help keep up neighborhoods kind of one house at a time. It doesn't do, you know, that many houses a year, but if you do one in a block or then you do one in another block, it's, you know, it over time, it's really almost, you know, it's almost like a mini tax levy that you're putting into. It's not a tax levy, but it's federal grants, but you're putting into this purpose basically to keep up your housing stock. And we've always viewed it as something really important. There have been some councils who have been less supportive than others over the years in the past, but we've always, you know, strongly advocated for it because we really think if you do one house on a block, you might get two or three others to go ahead and do something, and pretty soon you end up with a nice block.
You're talking specifically about the home rehab program.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
Yep. I had a question on
that. I would say there's some other things that have come out of this, and we also had some other funds, $200,000 one year that we also managed through these same people. I forget the name of the program. What was the one with the first home?
Oh, First Homes?
No, not the First Homes, but the rehab, the additional rehab money we worked with First Homes on. It was a federal
we
program.
We did the neighborhood stabilization program.
Right.
2013. Yeah. To buy those properties and rehab or renovate.
And that was a large amount of money, actually.
$1.3 million.
Yep.
Yeah.
So by having the staff available that's working on this, sometimes these other opportunities come up. So that's our plug for the program.
So one of the things that interested me is I've heard a lot about the ability to leverage other funds via this, and you kind of brought in some examples here, but one of them that I'm most interested in is the county HRA and trying to figure out if they'll be supportive to the point of how can we get and leverage some of that through the city? How do we get these economies of scale if we have both pots of money to pull from? I also like the idea of getting it to the point where it's rotating enough money where maybe we don't have to continue using portions of the CDBG to backfill it. But I'm kind of interested specifically, I don't know where the conversations are going with the county, how we could leverage, county dollars to maybe take our dollars further, hit more of the homes, because 30 homes on the waiting list. I mean, we give them all of the block grant money for this year, they're still not getting the 30 homes. We're getting the 18 or so, it looks like. So I'm wondering, if that's a conversation that can happen, who's the best person to have that conversation?
I can address that. So our staff has been meeting with the HRA staff and kind of talking through some of the programmatic opportunities for the HRA levy. And one of the low-hanging fruits is really to expand the home rehab. We have an established program, protocols, and the application process. We know we have people on the waiting list. But the CDBG program for Rochester is Rochester only. So we can use this as a model to more quickly expand and introduce this to other parts of the county. So we've been working with them, and we'll continue to do so in as much partnership as we can, and we'll continue to administer the programs as long as the city has the CDBG program and wants to do that, and we'll continue to do that for the HRA to the extent that they want to partner in doing that as well. One thing I want to mention too, though, is with the CDBG home rehab program, if you just take a look at the first handout that Teresa gave you on that third page, I think it's really important to point out there are different income eligibility limits, and I think it recognize that the CDBG program can help people that won't be able to compete for the MHFA homes. And it's really helping homeowners and helping homeowners, stay in their homes longer in many cases, whether it's providing some assistance for some infrastructure in the house, like a new furnace or water heaters and things like that, or it's adding ramps and changing out some windows. Again, it's helping people to stay in neighborhoods longer, but also helping to reinvest in the neighborhoods and stabilize and reinvest in them.
One other comment. I think, the staff will be talking to the Homestead County HRA staff, which they have a lot more experienced staff coming in with some of these new programs at the present time. But it does come down to more of a policy level, you folks talking to county board folks to find out where the priorities are for the use of their funding, because their funding is finite, and I don't know if their program will, one of their priorities will be to increase funding for the city rehab program in the city, or whether it'll be in other areas, or is it to go into, for example, additional affordable rental housing? I mean, there's a lot of different places that they can put the funding. So I think that's where, on the policy level, you guys have to have more of a discussion, I think, with the with your county counterparts on what are the priorities for their funding. This is a priority for our county because it's the only one that we control.
So what, Jeff?
You forgot the most important part. We used to have inflation eating away this pot of money.
Now we have interest.
Now we have interest to cover the inflation. And but the thing is, a lot of things we put money into, the money's gone. After that, a lot of times does really good stuff and the money's gone. This one, we're creating a reoccurring pool that's now stabilized in value. And it comes back slowly, but it does come back. And it's a asset for the community forever. It's kind of like a community endowment on this. That's why I pushed for the interest. And I thought we had to have them in today, so I already sent mine, and I put I had the $400,000 for that request in.
Can I just mention that when a lot of the reporting that I do with HUD, or if there's new programs or anything, they always want us to identify the blight neighborhoods, and Rochester doesn't have that, and it's, we might have a block here or a structure, but an actual neighborhood. So really the money goes to maintain it, and which is very valuable comparing to replacing it or improving it. And that's HUD is really intrigued the way we do not have slum neighborhoods.
I know it's always a difficult decision because none of us wants to slight any of the other causes. They're all worthy. just it's always a dilemma. We have about half of what we would is being requested, so tough choices.
And I don't think we've had the lecture enough this year, but distributing the money to a lot of different places is bad for everyone, especially Teresa.
I have to do it in agreement. I have to monitor. I have to every grant that goes out.
Yeah.
So I don't have to do it with the city home rehab program. How does that?
So the I would point out the secretary of the Department of HUD has heard about our home program, and the secretary of HUD thinks it's a fantastic idea, Secretary Castro. So okay. It's
quick question for Brent. On the sheet, there's a couple where it tells you the total you can allocate to that category. Yep. You want to explain?
Well, the top part is 79.5 and the bottom part is 106, right?
Yeah. That's administration.
Yeah, the public service is 15% of your allocation, which would be the 79, and the admin is 20%.
Which line items does that encompass?
So everything above the
79.5.
So it's 79 and then the total is 53.
So that 79,000 figure, that's any of those line items above that.
Correct.
And the 106, or what does that include?
That's administrative costs, right?
Just administration costs.
That comes out of the wide power.
Right. So if you go with the recommendation, you're going to completely cover.
Yep.
All
right. Thank you.
All right. Anything else for this afternoon? Then we'll see everyone this evening. Yeah.